Welcome back. Episode 25, Rock Under Fire.
What's up, Stick? Mike.
We are, for the first time, I think, we're flirting with anonymity tonight because we have a guest. And I guess we're going to get into...
Open the door and let him in.
Hopefully we'll get into anonymity's pants. Start with a little flirting. Never know how far we can take it.
We have Marlo, Dr. Marlo with us.
And nice.
Dr. Marlo is, I guess you're very much associated. You've written extensively on the 60s, on music, on rock and roll, on history, but you're very much associated with the counterculture.
It's been my field of study.
And we have a lot of connections to that. We were actually going to do 1967. This was supposed to be our big follow-up to last year's 66, and we're following this trend that kind of started. I mean, look, there's always a 50th anniversary of something, but they're always few and far between. But as we approached, I guess, the 50th anniversary of 1965, and when we're talking music, all of these landmark albums start coming out. And rubber Soul, and bringing it all back home, and Highway 61, and then we get into 1966, and of course last year we celebrated the 50th of things like Revolver.
Yes, we did.
And Blonde on Blonde, and Pet Sounds, and sure enough, Sgt. Pepper landing where it does in June of 1967, and it's just on and on from there.
Three more years, and we'll be celebrating our 50th anniversary.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's very much associated with the Summer of Love, which actually did it, am I right? It's kind of, the Summer of Love started in January.
Yeah, basically. Basically, it was the whole year, but it was labeled that when Sgt. Pepper came out.
And I guess we'll get right into our what's going on, because Pat has, like I said, he has some sort of a connection to 67, the first Grateful Dead album, and I guess what's left of the Dead, they're calling themselves Dead and Company,
Dead
and
Company.
So everybody kind of minus Phil Lesh, and obviously Jerry.
John Mayer was playing guitar and vocals, and amazing. The Allman Brothers fans out there, O'Teal is playing bass.
Now, I've said this before. I've said this before. Like, I'm not crazy about John Mayer's work, as far as like his solo work, his songs.
Okay,
I've heard him as a guitarist. I know he's a great guitarist. Give me your feedback, man.
Okay, that'll lead right into my into a discussion I actually had last night with somebody. His first, I believe, two albums, very pop, bubblegum pop music. I don't care for it at all. In fact, I went to see the Counting Crows one year, and the Counting Crows opened for him, and it was sheer music sales. That's all it was. I figured it should have been flip-flopped. But anyway.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear you say that.
Anyway, then I guess a few years after that or so, he puts out this, he gets together with this John Mayer trio, and things started changing. You started looking at this guy in a completely different light. I'm like, I was like, wow, this guy can really play guitar. Vocals, okay. There were three guys, though. It was just a three-piece, man, and the guy can wail, and and he just looks so comfortable in that setting with the Grateful Dead.
He's fitting in very well.
He really is, man. He's killing it. And all you hear are these really big-time Deadheads saying, well, Jerry can sing and play better. Well, okay, so fucking punch your ticket and go see Jerry play up in heaven. Well, what do you want me to tell you?
The Deadheads can be very unforgiving of anybody that's going to step into Jerry's
role. Yeah,
rightly so, man. I get it. I get it.
I do.
And
I
everybody that stepped into that role since Jerry, man, has
you
been
don't
under
stand
the
a chance.
Same...
I thought we were fucking music snobs. I've never been around the bigger... These guys are just picking apart every little fucking thing. I'm like, what? Wait a minute. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Because, I mean, it was...
These same guys that are critical are overall supportive, though.
Yeah,
they don't
absolutely.
Want him out. Is it like get him the fuck out of
no,
here?
No, not at all. No. But they're just saying he's no Jerry, Jerry.
Yeah. Well, shit, man. I know a lot of the card-carrying Deadheads, Jerry was that psychedelic style, and he just doesn't have that. He's a blues guy.
Yeah, you think Grateful Dead, you love the blues,
it's okay, but he's not going to take you into those mind-bending corridors that Jerry did, you know, and...
I heard, considering that mostly what I've heard of John Mayer is mostly good feedback. I know Trey.
Trey
was really criticized harshly for those five shows that they did in 2015 when they closed it out, when they supposedly were gonna
was that the Fare Thee Well or something like that.
Say
the
goodbye.
The two guys I went with were out in that Chicago. They went all three nights in Chicago to that event.
But yeah,
it was good, man. I can run through the set list, but you know, I wanted to talk about one other thing, and that's, I get the whole hippie thing, I guess. You know, I've never been in an environment where there were just so many. I'm surrounded by so many drugs in my entire life. You know, and I haven't done drugs in probably 20 years, and to see it. But what disturbed me were people with
these... You weren't surprised.
No, not surprised at all. No way. I mean, it's, you know, you've always heard it. There was no surprise.
Yeah.
But
I think I know where you're going. Let's see this.
There's people with these toddlers and little kids running around babies. Yeah. I'm not about that. I did not get... I have a 13-year-old. I'm not going to introduce her when she's 5 years old to that environment. No way. Live music? I get it. Yes.
Yep.
She's been to two shows. I'm all for it. But, I mean, there were people... Weekend, man. Eyes were they're yeah. bulging out of their heads and smiling and laughing. I was like, okay, that guy's tripping. That guy's on crank. That guy's on mushrooms. This one's doing it. It was really. I people watched the whole night. It was really cool.
That's is there a better place that people watch?
No,
but
there really
isn't. I thought of that, Dr. Marlowe. You must have too. You've been to a million shows. I'm sure you know. You see like hippie parents. You know, they're obviously tweaking out. What becomes of these kids?
Well, I think it's because of who the Grateful Dead were. I mean, the Grateful Dead basically represented the essence of what the hippie dream was really all about.
They really did.
Remember, their manager was Owsley, okay? And they played at the electric Kool-Aid acid test, okay? And Owsley made the acid, and Kesey was there, and the Dead were the house band.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, and they represented a certain lifestyle. It was that dream of 1967, of utopian dream. Dead represented it.
And I remember Weir saying there were nights where they couldn't even figure out how to play, and they just didn't play at like the acid fest. He was like, we couldn't do nothing.
Remember Jerry's nickname was Captain Trips.
Captain Trips, exactly right.
Captain Trips.
Oh, yeah.
Also Stephen King's death. That was in The Stand, Captain Trips.
Mm-hmm. I always marveled that any of these guys were able to play music in a state where you could barely take a step without universe.
And see all kinds of things. Yeah. Like I said, it's been 20, 25 years since I've done anything, but I did mess around with psychedelics.
I have a What's Going On.
O'Teal. He was the bass player for the Allman Brothers for a little while too. And man, this guy just can play. There was no shortage of musicianship on that stage last night. And the last thing I want to touch on is BB&T Pavilion in Camden. If you ever get a chance to see a show there,
it's BB&T do it, man.
I have no idea. I said big balls and testicles last night. Big boobs and titties. I don't know. But do it. I mean, you're right on the waterfront in Camden. I mean, you got to go through Shittsville to get there, but it's worth it.
Yeah.
You got a breeze coming off the water. The sun is setting over Philadelphia.
It could be a lovely place, man.
Perfect night, man. Perfect
Walt
night.
Whitman is buried in Camden. That's all that
needs
to be
said. Got to cross the Walt Whitman Bridge right there, man. You know? This is true. Here's something else that's changed, man. And one tried and true deadhead was saying, in this incarnation of the dead, you now have $300 and $500 VIP packages.
You do.
With bottle service.
Now, is this in relation to meet and greets where you get to hang backstage?
I don't think so.
Nope. The two guys I was with last night had the VIP. All they got you access to was like a bar that had like some hors d'oeuvres laid out,
right.
And
$300.
A bathroom that you didn't have to wait in line. And the guy told me his daughter works for like one of the companies, so he gets these free VIP upgrades. He goes, the Metallica VIP was fantastic. They had this huge spread laid out and all this food and everything like that. He goes, tonight, this one was shit. There was a couple of little hors d'oeuvres, some shrimp and stuff like that. And he goes, that was nothing.
There's a lot of that. A lot of these bands now who no longer sell, obviously you're not selling records anymore. You're not selling any tangible product. They've managed to get around the loss in revenue by having these meet and greets where, you know, you pay, I don't know, whatever it is, $500 for, you know, a front row seat, and then you go and get to meet the band and take a picture with them or whatever it is. A lot of artists are doing this now.
You've talked about that.
So when you said the VIP thing, I was just like, this is where the dead jumps.
I hope
the
dead don't go that far. Yeah.
No, there's not a meet and greet. Bob was good, man. Bob Weir was up there jamming, man. That guy is a great side man. What a great rhythm guitar player Bob Weir is. Yeah. And he just seems to enjoy it, man. He's just, he didn't play, I mean, he's slick on some of the, you know, little fills and stuff, but John Mayer had the brunt of the leads, and man.
Speaking of subject matter, let me shirt. Just got this, man.
We got a new shirt in the house. Yeah. Oh.
Stick Nixon has stepped away from the mic, so I know nobody can really hear what's going on, but he's trying on his new Dead shirt with the Prince symbol in the middle of the skull.
Very nice. You've seen these Grateful Dead steal your faces with usually a sports franchise and whatnot in the middle of the skull. This popped up on Facebook. I had to have it, man. I clicked right on there. I got the artist better known as Prince symbol within the Dead steal your face, purple.
Very nice.
I had to have it.
He's got the purple skull going on there. So for anybody that can't see it, is a Dead symbol, the skull with the Prince symbol embedded inside the circle.
You're gonna have to edit this, man. This is where I wanted to talk about, like, how used to talk about Prince, man, and Eighth Grade, man, and Little Richard, and James Brown, and all that.
Yeah, we gotta work that.
I want to harken back to that, man. Can't cross that off the list.
Oh, so you're not gonna leave your shirt on for the show, man?
It's a fucking fashion show it turned into.
What do we got now? What is this?
Jimi Hendrix Day of the
Zombie
Dead.
Hendrix.
I'm slowly replacing all my t-shirts.
This one looks like a cross between a skeleton, Tommy Chong, and Jimi Hendrix.
Tommy Chong.
So, yeah, I mean, what did they do? Iko. Casey
That's
Jones.
A song I can live
that
it out.
That makes me cringe, man.
Yeah, I can live it.
Casey Jones, Ramble on Rose, Brown Eyed Woman. I mean, they went into, you know.
See, I would have got up to take a pee during that, man.
No, I was downstairs for Drums in Space, which they've been doing on every, you know, every tour. The Wheel, Broke Down Palace, Stella Blue. I mean, you know, they did some cool stuff, man. I know off air we were discussing it a little bit. City Field was the night before, which was, I think, a little better of a set.
Right.
We only got one encore, but Virginia last week, holy shit. I mean, Virginia was I'm not a huge Dead guy. I just wanted to go to see what it was about. And Virginia's show, to me, would have been the show to see because it was a lot more familiar stuff, you know, stuff I would have known.
I'm somebody that, I love the Dead, man, but I'm not a Deadhead. I kind of champion the studio albums. Deadheads don't like the studio albums.
No,
man.
They don't.
They just kind of look down at the studio albums, man. It's all about live shows.
Is that true? If you, Dr. Marlon?
That, man. But,
what's the Doc's opinion on that?
Yeah, basically, you know, the Dead is a religion, really. It's a way of life. I mean, it's basically trying to recreate that, I said earlier, that the Haight-Ashbury dream and those jams, the psychedelic jams. You can't separate the Dead from the psychedelia.
Do you, in your living room at home, listen to, like, light live Grateful Dead bootlegs at all? Is that
I'm not a Deadhead myself, to be quite honest with you.
Not even the vinyl records?
No,
the studio stuff?
The studio stuff I listen to, and I saw them a lot, you know, back in the day. The Dead were great, but I never was a Deadhead. They were a little bit too far out there, you know.
The Traveling Circus. I mean, I regret not seeing it back in the day when Jerry was around. I absolutely regret not seeing it at this point.
Yeah, but you saw Jerry play? You never saw
never,
Jerry?
Never. Nope. Yeah.
Jerry Garcia Band was just one of the
They're phenomenal.
Amazing things.
I would almost rather see them in the Dead on a lot of nights.
And Jerry had one of those ethereal voices like John Lennon.
Yeah.
There was something about Jerry's voice that you can't replicate.
It was very unique.
Very unique.
You
can't replicate it.
They're doing a lot of Jerry stuff. I mean, you know, the way they're sprinkling it in, and it was good, man. I it was funny. Another thing I said was I had quite a 2 weeks. Talk about opposite ends of the spectrum. 2 weeks ago, I was at an Iron Maiden show, and then this week, I'm at the Grateful Dead. Yeah, I mean, where do I go from here?
That's what you hear on this panel. We're eclectic
the
that way.
The Omega.
Well, the last couple weeks, since we last met, we lost Anita Pallenberg. And I don't recall if that was...
No, we didn't talk about it on air. It was on our Facebook page.
Yeah. The look on your on Marlo's face, man, is just, you know, is just
Anita was
profound.
She was
it's a profound
one of the stones.
Loss,
she was one of the stones. She was a irrevocable part of that whole legendary period. Brian Jones's woman, and then Keith Richards, and was there. She was even in performance with Mick. You know,
she was with Brian first, huh?
Yeah, she was with Brian for quite some time, and then Brian really. He was a woman abuser. I mean, I love Brian, but Brian went up into the mountains, the Atlas Mountains, to record the tribal music. He came up with Jujuka, the Pipes of Pan, and he was dosed most of the time there. When he came down, Anita had left for England with Keith, and when he got to England, he had found out they were living together, which helped lead to Brian's meltdown eviction from the band in the early
mental meltdown.
Death,
right. Did not help.
On there. You know, but Anita, and then she stayed with Keith and had three children with him. So Anita Pallenberg is a very, very important part. If you love the Rolling Stones legend, Anita Pallenberg was so much a part of it.
That's going to lead me to a question about that. But, I mean, because there's all kinds of... Wasn't there speculation behind his death? And, like, I mean, you know, they found it. Did they find him in a pool? Was he drowned
in a pool? Drowned in a pool, and there was a lot of speculation.
Yeah,
that,
there was
that Mick and Keith were...
behind it and stuff like that.
So that book Rock Dreams, where the guy did... kind of cartoonish visualizations of rock and roll history. He had Mick and Keith dancing on Brian's coffin.
Oh, Christ.
You know,
wow.
About that. But Brian created the band.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mick and Keith took it over.
And they did. And they took it in a completely different direction,
and
right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And but yeah. Anita was, like I said, so much central. Anita and Marianne Faithfull, they were...
So she's their version of Yoko, maybe, right?
Oh, no way. Fuck.
Not breaking up the band?
Yeah.
A woman synonymous with a group. Yeah. I'll use that, a woman synonymous with their groups.
Yeah, Anita and Marianne could have been so destructive to the Stones, but the effect was not. You know, those girls really could have divided them. You know, and instead of, you know, Keith, instead of getting angry, well, maybe he did get angry.
Well, I can't believe that Yoko has just taken co-writing credits to Imagine.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, that's worthy.
Don't let me down, John, saying, well,
10
Yoko,
seconds.
Fucking,
yeah. Something like they, yeah. Yeah. It's,
she wouldn't let Paul flip on some of the ones that Paul was, that mainly wrote. He wanted to flip it to McCartney Lennon. And she wouldn't let that happen.
Really?
Yeah, like I'm trying to think of a big one.
Lennon McCartney has a nicer ring.
He was talking about
it in alphabetical order.
He was talking about it on Howard that he was trying to get Yoko to let him flip, like maybe yesterday or something like that. He was trying to get her to flip it, and she went.
Now, if you really the story of John and Yoko, I mean, she definitely had him. I mean, the last photograph that Annie Leibovitz took of him hours before his death, when he's nude in a fetal position,
yeah,
wrapped around her.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, I mean, that says it all.
That says it all.
He called her mama. You know,
that was the morning of December 8th. That was
It's
amazing how many pictures are actually available of John that day, man.
Yeah,
for, like,
he made himself
the
very available.
Day of his life.
He was always available. We had Bob Gruen on, man. He was really. We had a really good conversation with him. I mean, obviously that iconic shot of John in the New York City T-shirt on top of that building, and. He gave us some insight to that.
Right.
Yeah. But the he has also a shot, and I've said it before, that shot of Tina Turner that he took, man, is outstanding.
Yeah.
And he got lucky. He basically told us it was part luck how he got the shot. He was there and kind of had a 1 second exposure, right. And she was dancing off, and the strobes were going. And it's a ghost image of her spinning with all of her frills going. It was just tremendous, man.
Dr. Marlowe, we're getting back to Anita. You mentioned... she appeared in the movie Performance with Mick Jagger.
Yeah, she was.
And there is a nude scene with her and Mick in the tub. Is there not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And Keith is at home. And instead of Keith turning around and punching Mick in the face, writes "Give Me Shelter." At that point.
Yeah. No shit,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, he was.
The performance was 1970.
They were in the tub together. Yeah, so he channeled his energies into writing that song.
Wow, that's really tremendous. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
See, I don't know a lot about the history of the Stones, so you guys could definitely school me on that.
Legendary.
That's legendary. That's a good
times.
Story.
And, you know,
times.
Even in the bitter end, man, you know, she never got plastic surgery, you know, she never got breast augmentation. She was, her and Marianne, totally cool to the end, man.
Last time we heard of Anita Pallenberg was when a 17-year-old OD'd in our house in Long Island. And the cops were there, and the press was there, and Anita had put on quite a bit of weight, you know, at the time. That was kind of the last you really heard about her until just her passing away here.
It was a party, or was it somebody that she knew personally?
No, I think she was just, this is her, you know, she was seeing the kid, you know,
wow.
And playing with, I mean, the legends of Keith and Anita, the vampire stories where their heroine intake would go up to a point that became critical mass, and then they would pay two of the locals, this is the south of France at the time, to give them their blood. Oh. They would lie on separate tables while the blood was going out of Keith. The blood from the paid person was going into Keith to lower his heroin addiction, you know. And then they would pay.
Or fiction.
That's a fucking great story.
And the other part of it is...
The story is more important than the truth.
Anita and Keith would, like, perversely... give the help heroin as a little bonus for their thing, just to watch them get hooked. I mean, this is during the... Listen to Exile on Main Street. I mean, this is that period of time.
I will definitely do that.
You know, just read a book, Up and Down with the Rolling Stones.
What is it, Up and Down with the Rolling Stones?
Yeah. And there's a new biography. It just came out as well.
Okay, I will definitely, get, Stones biography. Definitely get that.
The Stones were a lifestyle. The Stones were, like the Dead were, you know, became a world unto themselves, you know.
Is that somebody who, that book written by somebody who was following them, or is it from the perspective of?
Don't recall the writer. I know there's a new book that's just come out on the Rolling Stones, which basically verifies the stories that were in the original one. But the Stones were always the counterpoint to the Beatles. You know, the Beatles were the good boys, and Andrew Lou Oldham made them the opposite, to be the bad boys of the Stones. And,
actually, that brings up something I wanted to ask you. I mean, Dr. Marlowe, really, growing up, did you sense, was there really like a divide between the Beatles fans and the Stones fans?
Absolutely.
There really was.
Absolutely. The Beatles, when they first came out, were for teeny bopper girls. They were a boy band, you know, and they played well, but basically anybody with any integrity generally didn't like the Beatles. But as soon as the Stones came out playing the blues, you know, they were bad. They were badass. And
this continues on through...
It didn't last all that long, because the Beatles had, you know, the musical cachet to prove themselves to be not just a boy band. And then together, they were always bouncing off of each other. Until, you know, Satanic Majesty's Request was the follow-up to Sgt. Pepper.
Right.
And Brian was violently against that album, because Brian was the blues.
Was he?
Brian was the blues, yeah. And they did their psychedelic album, which turned out to be, I think it's a brilliant album, but it turned out to be a commercial, Satanic Majesty Request,
brilliant,
turned out to be a commercial failure.
Because
they had gotten too far from what they were, and then the next album was Beggar's Banquet, where they got back to where they once belonged, you know, steal a Beatles line, you know, on there.
It's my aunt. My aunt's more of the Stones person than the Beatles person.
It remains one of my favorite albums from the Stones. Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah, well,
Sgt. Pepper.
Satanic.
Yeah, Satanic Majesty's Request.
I think it's far better album than Sgt. Pepper.
Oh, me too.
Absolutely.
Me too. And we just talked about Sgt. Pepper a couple weeks ago, and it was kind of like, you know, it's at the bottom. I mean, like, the worst Beatles album is, like, better than most groups' masterpieces. But, I mean, if I have to rank those albums, Sgt. Pepper falls kind of in the bottom three.
Well, the best two albums Beatles ever made were Revolver and Rubber Soul.
Yeah.
They hit their peak then. And then they went into this...
Road.
They went into this whole in the studio reproducing of psychedelia, which of course changed the world. I mean, which brings us to the topic at hand here, you know.
It's,
right.
But really. To the topic at hand. This is the Rock Under Fire podcast, and we got Dr. Marlowe with us. This is the anniversary of the Summer of Love coming up. We're here to talk about that and the counterculture with a card carrying, tried and true guy who was there.
Well, at this point, we were already in it in 67 because we're late June now. So Monterey had just taken place 2 weeks ago, right? And Sgt. Pepper had been released earlier in the month. So in the context of 50 years ago right now, we were right in the middle of it.
Right, exactly. This is where the Trips Festival happened in April. There was a Trips Festival in Golden Gate. Trips Festival in Golden Gate Park, you know, where the Dead were playing and Owsley skydived out of a plane and was sprinkling LSD to the crowd who were all taking it. And Allen Ginsberg was there dancing and chanting on the stage, and it was the birth. It was before the media got to it. If you had to be there, you had to be in the hate 1966 and through early 67.
Were you, did you have any experiences out west, or were you only strictly
no,
East Coast?
No, I was East Coast. East Coast. I was East Coast.
How,
get out
how
there.
Long did it take to transfer out here?
We were getting little indications of it through the media that something was going on big on
and
the
people
West
were
Coast.
Freaking
something
out
big
over,
on the
right?
West Coast. But over here on the East Coast, we had Andy Warhol and the Exploding Plastic Inevitable with the Velvet Underground, you know, and Nico. And that was another whole thing. But gradually, those bands started to come west, you know, I mean east. And Country Joe and the Fish and the Jefferson Airplane. I remember they played a show in the East Village because some Hell's Angels had been busted and they needed money. So they did a concert to raise the money for them. And it started to filter in, and the LSD from the East Coast, the West Coast started filtering into the East Coast over here. But it was always a yin-yang, East Coast, West Coast. And
it still is, actually. Yeah. Modern hip-hop, it always
yeah,
is.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Like hip-hop. Yeah,
even today, in 2017?
Yeah.
Is that
yeah,
really
absolutely.
True?
Absolutely. There's always a East Coast, West Coast thing.
But if you wanted to define it, you know, West Coast was Grateful Dead, East Coast was Velvet Underground.
Okay.
You know, and the Velvets, of course, ultimately led to punk. You know, and all of that.
It fits more, I think. You know, New York always had that that decadence about it, you know, so that you could see that movement.
More hard edge.
Yeah. And Southern California is just, I've been there, and it's just like, I got off that plane. I didn't have a care in the world, man. It was just mellow. I loved Southern California.
I went to see Dylan maybe about 10 years ago in Santa Monica, and Phil Lesh's band opened up for him. And I thought it was a time warp. Yeah. I mean, I was looking around. It was 1968 again.
Wow.
The long hairs and the psychedelics and the love, peace, flower power thing. It never really ended for a lot of people. And that circles back to what you experienced last night.
Oh, absolutely.
For a lot of people, it was a utopian dream. And there were a lot of people, especially what's going on now, would like to plug into that utopian dream again. You know, and you can do it by going to a dead show, you know, and trying to get into that headspace, you know, that strawberry feels.
That's a frightening statement, too, that you have to go see 70-year-olds to have that experience.
That is. It really, I mean, who's the, what would Fish be the band, a more recent band that would take that
very
mantle?
Very similar crowd.
That would take that baton? Because those guys aren't going to be around forever. I mean, we lost Greg. We're losing our idols at a record pace, just due to age, mainly. It's amazing how they did not take care of themselves.
But the point is that the zeitgeist has gone from there. That was the zeitgeist in the 70s. In the 60s, it was this whole new, the dream that John Lennon said ultimately was over. He already declared it over in 1970, 71. Dream is over, what can I say? Dream is over yesterday. You know, but there was that dream, that utopian dream, which basically goes back. I mean, it was so many lines going into it, and it was so much of the beats, basically the beats, what they were living on the East Coast in the village, on the West Coast in North Beach, living outside of the norms of society, taking hallucinogens, you know, and just nonconformity. A small group of people was ultimately turned into a mass movement through the medium of rock and roll.
Dr. Miles, did you ever have a moment where, like, you felt what John was saying, the dream is over, like you felt the air go out of you? Was there ever a time where, you know, you felt slapped in the face by reality, you know, like the change that we saw didn't quite happen?
If you were there, you knew it was over. you knew it was over. There was like so many body blows from the dream of 1967, the Summer of Love and all of that, just utopian thing coming to the Woodstock dream. We can really do it.
Scratch the surface in 1968, man. Month by month in 1968 was one blow after another, man.
But it was kind of a Manichean forces between good and evil.
Yeah.
You know, and that was evil. We know, you know, good and bad, we define these terms, you know.
Right.
And it leads to Woodstock, and it looks like they're really going to triumph. It's really going to triumph. And that was followed by Altamont, and it was followed by the Manson murders.
Huge.
Which at the time, a lot of hippies believed that was just put out by the press to discourage or to just, you know, tar the counterculture, that you could take LSD, listen to the White Album, and go out and commit a murder, you know. And then we found that it wasn't bullshit. It was real.
Yeah.
There were a bunch of hippies out there who took LSD and plotted mass, you know, murder, butchery. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, you had a perfect storm, right? Now Manson murders, like I said, Altamont concert, the death of the three big rock
stars. That was it,
too.
It was like one after the next. You know,
the Beatles breaking up.
Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, the Beatles break up. I think it was James Taylor said, dreams and flying machines and pieces on the ground, you know, and it really was. I mean, it was by 1971. You knew that dream was over.
That's a shame, man. I mean, you could almost see the media getting behind stuff like that and just pushing it out there and pumping it out, because they were very afraid of that movement. Sure. It scared the hell out of them.
Well, this is why they made hallucinogens illegal. LSD was illegal through 1966.
Yeah,
but in a competitive capitalistic society, you don't want people sitting communally and sharing things, you know. It's not going to be good for it, you know.
Yeah.
And Allen Ginsberg and Leary Aldous Huxley met somewhere, I believe it was 1965, on an island off the coast of Massachusetts to plot the course of where the counterculture could go through the use of LSD to enlighten people. And they had proposed setting up communes across the nation where anybody could go and take LSD with people who would be able to guide them through the experience. Pretty much what the ayahuasca thing is today.
Wow.
I know a lot of people that are doing ayahuasca. That's they nice. Go with shamans, they call them, and it's leading them through. And there was the dream, basically, of the enlightenment of the world through hallucinogenic drugs, you know. And the government basically, you know, put a major stop. Of course, the other thing was, you know, that LSD was too powerful a substance to be given out to everybody. I mean, it was something that you had to know what you were doing. It was massively powerful back then.
Irresponsible to spike the Kool-Aid, you know, to unknowing people.
Yeah, yeah. But it was transformative, and I believe that it was probably the central transformative moment of the 20th century because the ramifications of it are still with us today.
Still linger.
The environmental movement, you know, the way people eat today and, you know, the healthful things and just people living their lives in a way which never would happen in the 1950s.
No.
1950s was utter conformity except for small groups of people. And the 60s made nonconformity to become the zeitgeist to follow your own muse, your own dream. And you mix that with hallucinogens, which lead to mystical states, which becomes very much of Eastern religion. And that's where the Beatles come in, George Harrison. I mean, listen to Within You and Without You and Tomorrow Never Knows between Revolver and Pepper. And you've got the Vedantas, the Bhagavad Gita, there. And it led a lot of kids who were raised in a Judeo-Christian culture into a whole different way of looking at the world.
Yeah.
So basically what I said earlier, how the Beats started it, you know, Allen Ginsberg was like the father figure, you know, of everybody. It was picked up through the medium of rock and roll. That's the point, is that rock and roll started, this is the baby boomers, right? This is the baby boomers. And they were kids when rock and roll was born and stayed with rock and roll. And as they got older, rock and roll kind of faded away. Folk music came in. In comes Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan is an acolyte of Allen Ginsberg. Bob Dylan has absorbed what the Beats were doing, but he loves rock and roll, plugs in 65, takes the message of the Beats and puts it to a rock and roll beat. And every kid had a record player, and they were suddenly getting, they didn't have to read Howl. They could listen to Bring It All Back Home, you know.
Yeah.
And that spread. It spread like wildfire. And Timothy Leary at the same time was going around talking about how LSD could transform you. So at the same time, the rock and roll music was spreading this word. Leary's acid was spreading it. And then pretty soon every rock star worth his salt was taking LSD. And the visions of the acid was coming through the music, you know, and it spread through mass media until you had this utopian revolution lifestyle change.
Could you compare that moment of you know, you picture that the 50s before the before it all started and before rock and roll was, you know, it's almost like a black and white image or television, and you know, hi, honey, I'm home, and the kids are there.
Pleasantville.
And, you know, Pleasantville, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. I couldn't think of the word.
And little by little, it gets colored in.
Yeah, little by little, there's more color being added to it, and people are experimenting with different colors. It's not just black and white and grays, and here comes the blues and the yellows. I mean, can you, because obviously you've experienced it so much more than we have. You experienced it from that point forward. Is there any other time period that could even come close to that?
The period of the French Revolution. The French Revolution. Wordsworth said, "Oh, was it a joy to be in that moment alive, that to be young was bliss," because it looked like a whole new world was being born. The American Revolution had succeeded, and then the French Revolution. And the Romantic poets, if you get into people like Shelley and Byron and Wordsworth and Coleridge and Keats, there was a whole new vision, which then spilled over into the Transcendentalists, when you get Emerson and Thoreau and Whitman. I mean, Walt Whitman is God. There's no difference in that message.
Right?
There's no difference in that message. What those romantics were saying, what Wordsworth and Thoreau and Whitman were saying, is no different than what the Beatles were singing. Okay? But the thing is, those were in small, isolated groups of the romantic poets in Britain or the transcendentalists in New England. And then suddenly, through the medium of rock and roll, you had the baby boomers. Remember, they're a larger generation in history.
Yeah.
Being turned on through the music. And they had this elixir which opened their minds to things.
To the horror of mom and dad.
But again, you have to keep in mind that everybody who was listening to the Beatles and took LSD didn't turn into a hippie. You know, Leary used to say, turn on, tune in, drop out. A lot of people turned on and dropped out, you know, and never tuned in.
And never tuned into the
message. When the 60s were over, they just went on to the next thing.
You knew all the words, but you never quite learned the song.
You got it, man. You got it. Exactly. Exactly.
Just walk around now humming the melody underneath the bridge with a shopping cart or something.
But those that did tune in, their lives were never the same again, and they went out to become the writers and the filmmakers, the politicians, the teachers, etc. That went on, and it's still going on. It's still going on. I mean, but as I said, I believe there was a radical transformation of consciousness that occurred in the 1960s through all of those elements.
Yeah.
How big of an influence was all of this into your writing?
Tremendous. Yeah.
I mean, so that's that tune in part. You got the message.
Absolutely.
And you were like, okay, this is going to, you know, pen to paper.
Break on through to the other side.
Yeah, man.
DNA.
I was just thinking of that Door song right when Stick was talking. I was like, you know.
And one person I didn't mention was William Blake. And the Doors got their name from William. When you clean the doors of perception, you see things as they are, infinite. So it was all of that. There was nothing new under the sun in the 1960s. It was except that it was brought to a generation, the largest generation, like I said, through mass media, through rock and roll, which was religion, which I know the theme of the show, listening through it, is whatever happened to rock and roll.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
But it was from 1955 through about 1990, the central. Now it's become peripheral to the common culture. But it was the vehicle. I've often given the metaphor that when you went to a show, like in the Fillmore, it was a religious gathering. Everybody, first of all, took the Holy Sacrament of LSD, okay? And the people on the stage were also tripping. And the lyrics that they were going were the liturgy. They were the scripture. And the singers were the preachers, you know? And the
acid was
the sacrament. And you experienced this communal thing, which ultimately... Oh, I'll never forget that scene in Woodstock when Swami, I think it's Satchidananda, was looking out at hundreds, thousands of people meditating, and he said, they won't believe in India what's happening in America.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, this is what was... And then it all collapsed.
We were driving up there. I grew up there.
So this isn't happening at the Nickelback concert?
Yeah, no, definitely not. And we're driving up. We know the back way to get in there because now it's a big amphitheater now. Great place to still go.
Which place? I'm sorry.
Woodstock, the original Woodstock site, Yazgur's Farm. But there's a big amphitheater. It's a great place to still see a show. But we go in the back way so you can fight. We don't have to fight all the traffic out on Route 17. In fact, the picture on Time Magazine, I might have brought it up on the show. I think it was Time's cover. It's just Route 17. It's just nothing but cars and people on the cars. That picture looks like it was taken from my grandmother's house. That's her house was right on that road. But anyway, we're going through the back way, and my niece is with us. And I was like, oh, that's where all the hippies were bathing in that pond that you saw. And I mean, that's the spot. You literally point it right out. I got goosebumps thinking about it. It's just so cool to see that little history there and know what went down.
Yeah, you know what? You're a good person to ask. When Woodstock happened, was it immediately apparent, like, what a historically cataclysmic thing this was, or did it have to age?
Absolutely. While it was happening, it was aware that it was happening.
Did you go?
No.
Did you have the opportunity to go and didn't?
I was traveling at the time. I was out of the country.
I know more people who weren't able to go for different reasons. And I know another guy who was on his way there and ran out of drugs. They ran out of drugs and stopped and came back and didn't go.
Of course, every old hippie that now claims that he or she was at Woodstock, he would have had 100 million people there, you know, at the time. Well, the thing about Woodstock is that the media, and that probably what helped kill the hippie movement. Because, you know, it was supposed to be a small concert, and then people came from all over the country.
Turned it into...
And were willing to sit in mud and, you know, and listen to the music. And then the establishment got to see that a lot of money could be made from this. A lot of money could be made from this. And look at the more recent Woodstock revival.
Here's your $17 Pepsi. Yeah.
Exactly. And as with anything in this culture, it's commercialized.
And then they wonder why, you know, they're charging $6 for a bottle of water. People are dying of thirst. Yeah. The bathrooms are overflooded, those porta-johns with shit and piss. And you wonder why kids get aggravated at each other and they start beating the shit out of each other. And, it's a mess. It's a nightmare.
Between Woodstock in August, all right, so it's August and we're in 1969. And then within a year, John is declaring the dream is over. And in between, you have Altamont. What went wrong besides Altamont? Because I can't see Altamont. Because I've heard writers refer to Altamont, the apocalypse at Altamont, the death of the dream, the death of the 60s. The 60s ended at Altamont.
That was the Stones,
it
right?
It wasn't so Angels. Much.
Okay. Symbolically, man, I can see that.
It really
was. But
really was.
It wasn't so much the event of that late December of 1969 that brought it home. It was the film, the Melies Brother film of... When you sat and you watched it on the screen and you saw the other side of the counterculture. Yeah. And the same year came Easy Rider.
Okay.
And when Peter Fonda just looks at Dennis Hopper before he's blown away and says, "We've blown it, man. Blown it.
Yeah.
We fucking blew it. We had it." And if you were a Dylanologist, you know, you could see when Dylan agonizes over this in the basement days. Nothing was delivered. I say this truth to you, not out of fear or anger, but simply because it's true. We fucking blew it. We had it. Or did we? Can utopia ever be achieved? But if it's the utopia of the mind and people who have found an awareness of, and that's the whole thing of the ecology movement and interconnectedness of everything in nature. And that's where it's gone now. When you have people who are aware now of the interconnectedness of the entire cosmos and the flow of life in the cosmos, it kind of begins there, but it never ended, man.
That's what I was wondering, ended. Like just about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, like what is Neil Young talking about, man? That he said, what is it that he feels has died?
The hippie dream. Neil's obsessed with it.
Yeah, and he never got over it. And the fact that there was really nothing to not get over, because if you think about it, like you said, it's still being felt today.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the hippies won, man.
Absolutely. I mean, young people all the time
fully realized 50 years
later,
man.
These young people had never, you know, heard any of the 60s music or anything, but they're there. They're really beautiful people. And the way their lifestyle, the way they eat, and, you know, eating is so important. I mean, most people eat shit, you know. And,
yeah.
This is...
They're very kind and gracious, too. I mean, they're just, you know, they don't feel the shirt off their goddamn back if they go. It's just a
and they're not,
beautiful, beautiful.
They're
people,
racially
you know?
Pure.
No, yeah. They don't want anything in return for it. Hey, man, just... You know what? When you can help somebody down the line, you do that. Yeah. That's repaying me for what I did for you, and it's just a.
It's called karma.
Look at yeah, right. Yeah, exactly, man. Exactly.
Look at the 1950s. Study it, or look at any of the movies, or what was going on. And there was nothing of that going on like that. That's what I'm saying. There was a quantum leap in consciousness that occurred at the time, and it's kind of the rock being thrown in the center of the pond, and the ripples keep going on and on, and the. Ripple number 75 has no idea the rock ever hit the pot, but it just got the vibe on it, you know. And that's
I guess you answered that question, man. I mean, you presided over all these social changes, women's movement, civil rights, the environmental movement.
Absolutely.
And, but how do you reconcile that with President Trump, you know? And I guess that's how...
Because it's a Manichean universe, and there's always going to be the battle between good and evil. And it's never, ever going to fucking end, man. It's never going to fucking end.
Yep. You're right.
You know, but consciousness is consciousness, and I don't worry about the age of Trump because I know it'll be some
pendulum is always
something larger, you know.
That's great.
But, we're hot again.
Oh, all right.
This is the Whitney. I was remembering the modern. 10 years now removed we are from the 10 years it's been since this.
Was that the Summer of Love exhibition?
The Summer of Love exhibition. Was it 25 years at that point? Or is my math all retarded?
Happening in, Psychedelia.
Is the cover of Nashville Skyline.
What do you got there, Stick?
All I remember was going there with Mike over here. Our old guest, Michael Nierenberg, was there with us. And it was an amazing art installation.
Cool shit,
with
But where did they arrive at Nashville Skyline?
Yeah, I don't know,
man.
How Nashville Skyline
even
got in the poster,
that took out that came out 2 years later.
This was an exhibition?
Yeah,
in the city?
Huge exhibit, man. Of art,
that's cool.
And music and everything psychedelic, summer love, man.
It was pretty
that
definitive.
You could walk into that were, you know, sensory and tactile and nuts.
Wow.
That's my big memory of it. Walking into one room, you were there, man, with Nierenberg, man, and there were some really cool psychedelic rooms, but this one, the effects were kind of lame, just like one blinking light. We're all laying there looking up at Nierenberg. This acid sucks.
Look at that. You're folding the wrong way.
I just always...
That's, you know, I should get that laminated, man. That's,
there you go.
Yeah, you really should laminate it or frame it, man.
Poster, yeah man.
Absolutely.
Poster that thing up.
This definitely should be this. This should be on your wall, man. Take South America down.
Yeah,
put that up there.
There you go.
The Rock Under Fire Studios needs that image up, bro.
Yeah, really, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
can't give away any of our mystique.
Redeemed Nashville skyline by putting that image on a Summer of Love thing where like Bob was all but invisible, man.
Yeah,
that year.
Yeah, the prophet had left.
The man that said the times they are changing was not around that year.
Well, Dylan, it was central to it because Dylan is the one who absorbed the lessons of the Beats and brought them to Middle America. Eisenhower's America becomes the Kennedys' America, and the lessons that Allen Ginsberg and the other Beats had gotten through to Dylan, he puts it with his genius into poetry. I mean, listen to "It's All Right, Mom, Only Bleeding." You know, I mean, that entire side of the album.
What do you say after that? I mean,
everything you need to know is in that song.
After that song, it's all in there.
And Dylan brought this message out. The problem with Dylan is that it became the singer, not the song. And he wound up having people looking at him as the man who had all the answers, which drove him to near death, you know, by 1966. And he wanted out. He wanted any fucking part of it.
Yeah, that's a lot of pressure.
I never warned you when your train gets lost. You see where this is going.
Yeah.
You know? Dylan pulled out, and when he pulled out, I mean, it was basically his message that he had been booed. They were Dylan when he goes electric. Mm. This is the only way. How many people listen to folk music, but all the kids are listening to rock and roll. And Dylan took the message of the Beats, put it to a rock and roll beat, created this symbolistic poetry, which could be interpreted any way that you wanted to, you know. And then when you add psychedelics to listening to Blonde on Blonde, you know, and Dylan splits and goes into basically a hermetic up in Woodstock. He doesn't want any part of what's going on. And what's going on is that the lessons that he had thrown out, the seeds germinated.
Right.
They germinated. And by 1967, in the Haight-Ashbury is where they really germinated. You know, but like I said, you had all the various things because Ken Kesey, you know, and Robert Hunter, which is interesting because it was the CIA, some people have said, that created the counterculture. Because in the early 60s, the CIA was paying people to take LSD to see what the effects would be, because they were thinking about using LSD in some kind of warfare weapon.
Right. And films of this can be found on YouTube for anybody listening.
yeah. And
what, do they have films of people that they're actually testing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Wow. Or read Ken Kesey's The Electrical and Acid Test. Yeah. Wow. You know, and these people that were taking LSD for the Army and the CIA were basically having transformative experiences of consciousness, you know, and they went out into the world, and you know, and then Leary was expelled from Harvard with Albert, you know, what's Richard Albert?
Yep, yeah. Richard Albert, Ram Dass,
aka Ram Dass.
Right, yeah, and he just had found that this, he felt that this could transform the world. And spreading the message of LSD in the early to mid 60s. At the same time, Dylan was taking the acid, and then Dylan turned the Beatles on to marijuana, and they moved the next logical step onto LSD. And the Beatles were the biggest band in the world. So we talk about a conveyor belt.
Yeah.
Alpert's basic philosophy on psychedelics, and I'll try to paraphrase, was that psychedelics made us look at power structures as rather flimsy creations of the human intellect. So we looked at, you know, so if you went to Washington to see the power of the government, you know, and you saw it was just this creation of a bunch of paranoid people, mm-hmm. you know, the yeah. mint, and we're supposed to look like this, and we're supposed to, and that kind of fueled things like the civil rights, well, not the civil rights movement, but the anti-Vietnam movement.
But that was going on as well.
And it was going on. That was rooted in just plain consciousness, man, other than what would come from psychedelics. But it kind of jump-started it to a large degree, I think. According to Alpert, to Ram Dass.
Right. The 60s were the single most revolutionary decade of the 20th century, you know, because you had the civil rights movement, you had the anti-war ban the bomb movement, you had the rising of the Vietnam War and the opposition to it, you know, you had the, once the civil rights movement had basically shown what could be done through civil disobedience, you had, you know, Mexicans, women's, gays, all looking for their own liberation, you know, on there. And you had the sexual, it was sexual, it was political, it was spiritual. There were all revolutions going on simultaneously with an utter transformation of the society. On there. And it was through the medium, getting back to the centrality of this entire
music
show, Rock Under Fire, is that rock and roll at the time was the vehicle. A ghetto music that had been born in the 50s, that basically took outsiders, you know, outsider music, you know, blacks, Appalachian hillbillies, people from the Deep South, fucking breaking into the system, in 10 years had become the vehicle for this transformative message. See, the problem with it, though, if you talk about rock and roll, is that the fun of Little Richard and Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry was subsumed in the ponderance of the message, you know?
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden it became this very heavy thing that, you know, people listen to and everything, and you just forgot that rock and roll could be fun?
Maybe got Bob to blame for that.
Thanks, Bob.
Oh, yeah, yeah, really, really, you know? And this is kind of what punk was, like a purgative, you know, to get rid of this shit, man. Buddy Holly just needed a guitar, drums, and a bass, man, and he fucking created incredible music. What do you need all of this stuff for? But some people, like, we talk about Sgt. Pepper, but a lot of people have called Sgt. Pepper the Beatles, you know, destruction of rock and roll. Because
an entire book was written around it.
Seriously?
Yeah, how the Beatles how the Beatles killed rock and roll or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. He used to listen to the early stuff right through Revolver.
Yeah.
And then you listen to that, and all of a sudden it became very heavy and ponderous. And by the time you hit the 70s, you know, when you had the progressive rock of Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, and who were the other ones?
Yes.
Procol Harum.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, all of that. And then, you know, it got bigger and bigger, you know. You know, Bowie and Alice Cooper putting on huge productions and everything. That's why you needed the Ramones.
That's why I needed Bruce, too. Bruce was a nice
Ramones brought it
fresh
back
air.
To the primal.
Yeah. To the primal. Rock and roll really was all about.
The primitive nature of the blues, the simplicity of it, the Ramones brought that back.
Yeah. I have another quick question about the whole Altamont thing. You know, obviously... you know, the Hell's Angels were responsible for the chaos that took place there, or partly so. But what was
a lot of bad acid,
bad drugs,
a lot of bad acid there.
Yeah, but what was their thing? What were they about? I mean, how did they even get involved in that? First of all, obviously security, but I mean
Jerry Garcia.
Yeah,
and also the Stones in '69 when Brian Jones. Well, they didn't know Brian was going to be dead at the time. The Stones had a free concert in Hyde Park.
Yeah.
Okay. The Stones had not performed in 3 years because of the multiple drug busts, and that was one of the reasons why they get rid of Brian, because he was the establishment wanted to destroy the Rolling Stones, and they realized that Brian Jones was the weak link. They kept busting him. They busted me, Keith. They busted Mick. So they didn't perform, and then Cream performed in Hyde Park, a free concert. Okay, so the Stones decided to do their own free concert in Hyde Park, and basically that was, you know, the comeback, you know, of the Rolling Stones.
And the Beatles had met the Hell's Angels too, did they not?
Well, the Angels, getting back to the central point that you asked, was the British Hell's Angels were the guards of the stage in Hyde Park.
Yeah.
But they were all like 16-year-old boys. They were these baby-faced kids. They weren't the Hell's Angels of the West Coast.
Yeah.
Well, that's, and my question was, where were they involved? You know, where were they before that in the whole hippie movement?
Well, you know the story, right?
Oh,
right.
Yeah. I read Sonny Badger, I think. He was the leader. I mean, I read his book. It was fantastic. And how the whole start of it, how he just wanted to start a club and, you know, all the shit that they were doing.
But the connection between the hippies and the Angels happened in Haight-Ashbury, because the Angels thought the hippies were a bunch of drug addled faggots, you know.
Right.
And Alan kind of led a march towards the Angels, and the Angels were ready for a fucking brawl. They thought this was really going to happen. And Alan went over to the head of the Angels and kissed him.
Oh, Christ.
And gave him a flower and said, I love you.
I wanted to get to this because the Angels
expected anything but that.
Yeah.
And they just looked at and they said, you guys are fucking weird, man, but like, we like you. And basically, anybody bothers you They got to get past us.
We got
first.
You.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. So the Dead and especially the Grateful Dead,
sure.
You know, with the Angels. So when they needed protection, Mick had said, we got the Angels to protect us in Hyde Park. And so the Angels protected them at Altamont. But the thing is, when the government had made LSD illegal in 66 and busted Owsley, who was the Dead's manager and the main producer of it, the mob got involved in the production of LSD. Huh. And they were cutting it with strychnine and all kinds of shit, you know. And it became a lot of really bad acid, which was already at Woodstock. That line, don't take the brown acids, you know, that kind of thing. So there were a lot of people taking the LSD. And that's one of the things that I want to bring out is that I think of the – basically most of the things that the 60s were for were really good, you know, like peace is better than war, love is better than hate, you know, eating natural foods is better than eating – bacon cheeseburgers and shit like that, you know, that kind of thing. But the idea that taking drugs was a wonderful thing, because initially the drugs taken by the original hippies were sacramental. They were sacramental, okay? You would take those for religious purposes. And, you know, and the transformations that occurred at the time there. But by the next generation coming, they just wanted to get high.
It got out of hand and became destructive. And
exactly.
More synthetic, too, is what I mean, would that be fair?
Well, it was basically a wannabe thing.
Yeah.
The younger kids looked up and they saw, you know, John Lennon, Bob Dylan, you know, the rest of them. Oh, I want to be like them, you know, and I'll grow my hair long and take a lot of LSD and or a lot of drugs and be cool. And I think Peter Townsend captured it most brilliantly in Tommy, because Tommy is the deaf, dumb, and blind boy who goes on the amazing journey and comes back to tell people about it. And his parents, to make money, decide to exploit it instead of Tommy Holiday caps, you know, and, you know, just put the plugs in your mouth and the eye things and the ears and you could be like Tommy. And Tommy's going, no, it's not like that. It's something different. And remember the kids, you know, we don't want no religion.
Right.
You know, we want to be like you. You know,
if I told you what it takes to reach the highest high, you'd laugh and say nothing's
exactly.
that simple.
So the religious nature of psychedelic drugs from the early to mid 60s got lost in the thing of the commercialization of rock and roll and the image of the counterculture.
Huge.
And that led to what I believe is the epidemic of drug abuse that we've got in our culture.
Tommy's
been
the anti-drug album from that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, well,
from that message.
Well, Townsend was a student of Mihir Baba.
Yeah.
One of the gurus. And remember the Beatles for a while, you know, tuned to a natural E and happy to be that way, you know, and Donovan, and a lot of them had gotten into the Eastern spiritual. So that was the thing, that LSD opened the third eye to the mystic, and it was Ram Dass that said it. He would be taking LSD every 6 hours to try to stay high and kept coming down. And then he went to India to learn that you didn't need to do that. There was another way. And George Harrison had done the same thing, that there was another. In other words, the goal was enlightenment. The goal was union with the cosmos, the realization of one. And LSD could show you that it does exist. But if you had to keep taking LSD to get there, man, you're fucking missing it.
All it has to do is show you once.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You show it over
so
and over.
Meditation.
And well, the truths of the East. Of basically, turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. It is not dying, you know.
When it
lay down all thoughts, surrender to the void. It is shining, and you'll know the meaning of within.
So,
being.
When it comes to the death of the dream, that's the elephant in the room. We don't talk about, you know, death of Jim Morrison, Altamont, Manson murders, but bad drugs, people losing their respect for the drugs. It's a party thing now, not a sacramental thing. Not to mention, as you get into 71, 72, a lot of the veteran hippies have been into this lifestyle for going on 7, 8, 9 years now. You know how it goes. Things go downhill. Things are starting to get ugly, you know. It's not fun anymore. They're getting into dirtier stuff. So they're not doing Owsley acid anymore, you know. They're doing garbage. Smack and heroin.
So it was a brief shining moment.
Yeah,
there was that brief shining moment. There was that brief shining moment when everything, all the lines converged. Okay, you had Leary, you had Dylan, you had Ginsberg, you had rock and roll becoming the manifest great art form that it became by the mid '60s. It all kind of converged in 1967, the summer of love. It seemed that it was all there, and that the dream, the utopia, the hippies believed that they were the forerunners of the Aquarian Age.
It was like a prism. But that was one of the things that they said
that the Earth was moving out of the constellation of Pisces, which is a conflicting, you know, sign, into the age of Aquarius. That's where they, the Aquarian children and everything, and really believed that. There was a book by Arthur C. Clarke called Childhood's End, you know, where the aliens were coming in and they actually form another planet and then they get to the children. It's always the children. You know, the children will lead, and the hippies were, the children were going to lead us into the Aquarian Age, this utopian age. It didn't last that long. By the end of the 60s, the dream had pretty much crumbled. And getting back to what you said at the very beginning of this, is why do these people go to the dead concerts and do that and live that? Because a lot of people would love to go back and tap into that, or at least live it now with themselves, and when they are with the dead and listening to that music and doing those drugs, they can do it. And who's to say it's not legitimate what they're doing?
No, exactly. I just wouldn't do it, you know, as far as the children's
place,
side of it.
They attain that, even if it's for
Exactly.
I know, back to the garden.
Yeah.
I might be putting myself out there a little bit by saying this, but I know that, you know, in my past, I have had the opportunity to take some good acid, and it just put me in a place that I don't think I'll ever get to again, ever. I mean, one, because I just don't do it. I can't do it anymore, and yeah. I don't.
Was it positive or negative, though?
Positive. Completely positive. I mean, don't get me wrong. I have had bad trips, and that's just because of the drugs that were there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I can remember one vividly, and it just put me in a spot, and I know the record I was listening to and, you know, where I was
I think I don't think the counterculture would have happened hadn't it been for LSD.
No.
You know, Dr. Hoffman accidentally finds it in 43 during the war, you know, and the formulas there are Sandoz.
Like you said, it wanted to be a weapon. They wanted to use it as a weapon.
Exactly. They were going to weaponize it.
Yeah.
But it was there, and that basically what, through the wonders of chemistry, hallucinogens that have been there since our species first started to think. Terence McKenna, passed away recently, basically posited through most of his books the theory of the human consciousness achieved the state that it did through our Paleolithic ancestors taking hallucinogenic drugs, finding mushrooms and herbs and things
like that.
And evolutionarily better survival mechanisms, etc. But suddenly, instead of having certain cactuses or mushrooms, you could mass produce this. And Sandoz did it. Owsley was a chemist. Owsley got the formula for it. Owsley started to mass produce it, okay? And it spread throughout the country and a good part of the Western world. And for that very brief period of time, when it was still that pure Owsley-Sandoz acid, people took it, and many of them had the mystical experience that was done by all the sages in history, okay? Yeah. And for a brief moment, you could be Plato, or you could be Blake, you know, you could be Whitman, you can, you know, to do that. And once you've done that, once you've broken on through to the other side, you know, the incredible string band, you know, once you find out who you are, it's beautiful beyond your dreams, you know.
Ooh, it was deep, man.
You know, so, and just listen to Incredible String Band, you know, if you want to know what that it's really all about. Of course, string band are an acquired taste, but I mean, if you listen to the string band, I mean, it's Lao Tzu with a guitar, you know, playing that stuff here.
There's no doubt that the LSD was of seminal importance. I mean, you look at footage of people in the 60s, and you don't put glitter on your face or flowers in your hair or dance with
them. You know, Abby Hoffman once said that he didn't trust anybody who never took LSD. What I find interesting now, and I know a lot of people that are into the ayahuasca, and this seems to be the new psychedelic era, a rebirth of it.
High schools, that stuff.
Yeah, and a lot of them, it's organized where they have a shaman, someone there, a trip master, they used to call it back in the day, you know, to do that. Which is interesting, though, about the ayahuasca. This is the Yagjay route that William Burroughs went into the Amazon to find. And then he told Allen Ginsberg about it, and Ginsberg went to try the Yagjay, and there's the letters of Ginsberg and Burroughs talking about this. Wow. So this is back in the 50s. And that's what I'm saying about the Beats being the progenitors, because they were doing in the 40s and 50s what ultimately became the mass culture of the 1960s, you know. And it was Zimmerman, you know, who took that and then turned the Beatles on, who then turned everybody on. And then, and as Dylan proved that anybody could be a poet if you had it within you. Pretty soon, every rock band, you had your Jim Morrisons and Jimi Hendrix and, you know.
Ripple effect.
Well, Jerry didn't write the songs. It was Robert Hunter. But, I mean, all the great rock poets that came out from the end of the 60s all the way through, yeah. It was a renaissance. It was a renaissance. And as I said earlier, the society's never been the same, you know, because of it.
Anyway, hey. We're just a little bit over an hour now with that. I mean, I find no better place to wrap up.
Let's let Dr. Marlowe go, man. This dude.
Dr. Marlowe, it has been an honor to have you, man. You have elevated what was supposed to be 1967 into a full
lesson.
Kaleidoscopic conversation on the counterculture, man. One that had to happen inevitably on this show, and it fell right into place in the 50th anniversary of the Summer of Love.
For you.
No better place, man, and time for you to join us, man. And
it's been an honor.
Thank you.
We
thank you for
doing
what you're doing today.
For you guys out there listening, I said off air, sitting here, you know, you guys will hear him speak, obviously, you know, Dr. Marlowe, but sitting here and listening to him speak, it was enlightening. I hope you guys get out of it what I did.
That's why we keep him around.
You know, I just wanted to share that. That's why we keep him around. I just wanted to share that, and I'll thank
We're
you.
We're going to plug him back in now. And
plug him back in. Back into the cryogenic chamber, you.
Oh, man. All right. So Rock Under Fire.
Peace
We're
out.
With Dr. Marlowe, Mike DiRico here, Pat Ivanitsky, and Stick Nixon.
That's me.
We will see you back in July for number 26. Follow our shit.
Bad news, but only if you're out of me. Bad news, but only if you wanna be. You can lose, but I know how you love to win. Break my head down and pick me like a javelin. Whoa, you said we can't all be dumb. Bad news keeps pouring on me. Bad news.